Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, a story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on August 13th as part of the Arizona Watchdog Project. The Arpaio All-Stars meet the county sheriff's sketchy retreads. Despite giving Joe Arpaio a birthday hug in June, new Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan has repeatedly and publicly distanced himself from Arizona's most infamous law enforcement officer. Sheridan may have been Arpaio's second in command back in the day, but he insists he has no interest in using his office for immigration enforcement. He promises to fully comply with the orders of federal judge G. Murray Snow, who has kept the sheriff's office under his thumb for more than a decade as a result of the Melendrez v. Arpaio racial profiling lawsuit. Now, Melendrez v. Sheridan. The message from Sheridan is clear. He ain't no Sheriff Joe. It's true that the 67-year-old Sheridan is a pale shadow of his Machiavellian former boss, who once bestrode Arizona like a gloating, malevolent colossus. But it's not quite true that Sheridan's reign carries no Arpaio-esque echoes. Like his erstwhile jefe, Sheridan inexplicably rocks five stars on his collar. The standard is usually four. And Sheridan occasionally espouses revanchist fantasies of bringing back a revamped tent city, or beefing up the much-diminished sheriff's posse, both old calling cards for old Joe. Other signature Arpaio policies, like pink underwear, chain gangs, and green baloney, have yet to make a comeback. But Arpaio-era people, especially those with pockmarked records, certainly have. To fill out his command staff, Sheridan has drawn heavily from ex-Arpaio minions. Since taking office in January, Sheridan has hired, rehired, or promoted at least four notable figures from the notorious Arpaio era, surrounding himself with some of the same badge-wearing bubbas who helped place the sheriff's office under federal scrutiny in the first place. One retired sheriff's office insider, who asked not to be named, called the new command staff Arpaio Light. You can't say that you're not like your former boss when you're checking all the exact boxes that your boss checked, the insider said. It's the same players, the same roster. Among those Arpaio All-Stars are Paul Chagola, who once reportedly threatened to call Child Protective Services on an uncooperative local reporter. Jeff Gentry, who led a unit that was often sicked on Arpaio's biggest critics. Steve Bailey, who was once recommended for federal contempt proceedings. And Chad Willems, a political strategist with zero law enforcement experience. Sheridan's even brought back old-timer Raleigh Siebert to be his executive chief of custody. Siebert, who retired in 2012, had been gone so long that county officials had a hard time finding his personal records when Phoenix New Times asked. Sheridan may be putting the band back together, the insider said, only they're a lot older and don't sing as well. But it'd be a shame to forget their greatest hits. Here's a refresher on what Sheridan's moldy-ass crew of flunkies did so poorly the first time around. Paul Chagola, Deputy Chief. Chagola is a one-time acolyte of Arpaio's former second-in-command, David Handershot, whom Arpaio fired in 2011 in the wake of an abuse-of-power scandal that threatened Arpaio's reign. For many years, the rotund Handershot literally and figuratively played the heavy for Arpaio, retaliating against anyone inside or outside the sheriff's office not sufficiently deferential to Sheriff Joe. That included recalcitrant employees, judges, county supervisors, and mayors. It also included the former owners of New Times, who were arrested in 2007 after the paper exposed bogus grand jury subpoenas seeking identifying information on New Times online readers. Chagolo was once a much-despised member of Arpaio's public information unit, with a well-earned reputation for puerile, bellicose behavior toward journalists. In 2011, an outside investigation revealed that Hendershot and Chagolo had threatened a local reporter with arrest for refusing to cooperate on a probe of county officials. They warned her several times that if she did not comply, Child Protective Services would take her kid. Arpaio's top in-house flack told investigators that Chagolo was clearly under the thumb and influence of Hendershot. By that time, Chagolo was no longer doing PR for the sheriff, having been promoted from lieutenant to deputy chief. After Hendershot was fired, Chagolo remained with the agency. When Paul Penzone became sheriff, he bested Chagolo down to captain in command of a district that included the hotbed of crime known as Sun City. Pressed on Chagolo's continued employment in 2018, Penzone said Chagolo had his support and had worked hard in the community, offering tongue-in-cheek that Chagolo was deserving of the position he currently holds. A few weeks after being sworn in this January, Sheridan promoted Chagolo to resume the rank of deputy chief as commander of the Sheriff's Patrol Resources Bureau. Chagolo now oversees several divisions, including aviation services, SWAT, and court security. According to a county spokesperson, his annual salary is $207,408. Jeff Gentry, undersheriff. A stalwart Sheridan apostle, Gentry scored the plum position as Sheridan's undersheriff, which is the same role as chief deputy, but perhaps without the negative connotations that resulted from Hendershot's misdeeds in that role, and later, those of Sheridan himself. Gentry, who retired from the sheriff's office in 2020, was once the sergeant of the Selective Enforcement Unit, formerly known as the Threat Assessment Squad, or Threat Management Unit, which was involved in many questionable capers in the Arpaio days. The unit was accused of targeting political opponents and critics of Arpaio, often at the behest of Hendershot. Hendershot would later take credit for the unit's 2007 nighttime raids on the homes of former New Times owners Michael Lacey and Jim Larkin, ending in wrongful arrests that spawned a lawsuit that the county paid $3.75 million to settle. Hendershot also reportedly sicked the unit on Nick Tarr, a Sheriff Joe impersonator who went by the name of Joe Arizona and wore a trick-or-treat-style getup involving an old Department of Public Safety shirt and a pair of pink boxers. Hendershot ordered members of the squad to cite the comedian for impersonating a law enforcement officer. Additionally, Hendershot used the squad in 2004 to help smear Arpaio's political rival at the time, former Buckeye Police Chief Dan Sabin. The sheriff's office boosted the unfounded allegation that Sabin had raped his adoptive mother when he was a teen, supposedly more than 30 years prior to her decision to report it to the sheriff's department. Sabin insisted that he was the victim in the episode, but the smear did undeniable damage to his candidacy. It was the kind of character assassination the KGB perfected during the old Soviet Union, known as kompromat, at which Hendershot was a past master. During the Sabin investigation, Gentry, then a detective, interviewed Sabin's adoptive mother and wrote up the report as ordered. His superior at the time was along for the ride, Sergeant Steve Bailey. According to Maricopa County spokesperson, Gentry's salary as undersheriff is $209,636. Steve Bailey, Executive Chief of Enforcement. Bailey, a former sergeant of the Threat Squad, who was directly involved in both the Tar and Sabin investigations, is Sheridan's pick for Executive Chief of Enforcement, which oversees all enforcement and detention personnel. Sheriff's Office spokesperson Chris Hegstrom confirmed that Bailey has been offered the position, and Bailey told New Times that he was inclined to take it. "I'm pretty sure I'm going to do it," he said. "I'd like to be there sometime this month." Bailey said he would report to Gentry in the new role, a man he had known for years and years. He added that he believed Sheridan was doing it for the right reasons, and that this might be a really good chapter for the sheriff's office, without all the sideshow nonsense, if that makes sense. But back in 2015, both Bailey and Sheridan were knee-deep in that very sideshow, particularly the civil contempt trial of Arpaio and his underlings before Judge Snow. Snow had discovered that Arpaio and the sheriff's office were violating his orders not to enforce federal immigration law. Snow also discovered that Arpaio was using a confidential informant in Seattle, a supposed computer whiz with a dubious past, to investigate a cockamamie conspiracy theory that involved the Obama White House, the Department of Justice, Snow, and a law firm working for the plaintiffs, among others. The judge ordered the sheriff's office to cough up all records having to do with the Seattle operation, plus evidence related to the agency's violation of his orders. Instead, the sheriff's office attempted to hide the existence of 50 hard drives related to the Seattle investigation and nearly 1,500 IDs that had been confiscated by the agency, many of them from Latino drivers. Snow was pissed when he found out about the cover-up, ordering the U.S. Marshals Service to seize the evidence. Both issues became part of the contempt proceedings. By this time, Bailey was head of the agency's Professional Standards Bureau. As captain of PSB, he'd opened an investigation into the 1,500 IDs, which he later told the court Sheridan ordered him to pause. Ultimately, Snow concluded that Bailey gave a knowing and false report to the court's monitor about the existence of the IDs and referred the matter to another judge for possible criminal contempt proceedings. Bailey was spared when the Department of Justice eventually took the position that the one-year statute of limitations on contempt of court had expired. Arpaio was later tried and found guilty of criminal contempt, only to be pardoned in 2017 by President Donald Trump. Unlike Sheridan, whose prevarications and misconduct earned him 2 civil contempt citations from Snow, and a spot on Maricopa County's Brady list of cops with honesty issues, Bailey eluded any lasting consequences. He retired from the sheriff's office in 2017 and, until recently, had been working at his own security firm, RPI Consulting, in Chandler. Bailey insisted to New Times that he pushed back hard on some of the things Arpaio wanted and had testified truthfully before Snow, which he said displeased Arpaio. Asked if he thought his work for Arpaio cast a pall over his career, he said that he hoped not. "Sheriff Arpaio just did things differently," he said. "I didn't always agree with it." Bailey said he thought he made good decisions in the Arpaio years. Sheridan, Bailey claimed, never asked Bailey or others to do anything hinky because it was never part of his DNA. Bailey's salary for his new role has not been made available to New Times. Chad Willems, chief of administration. Willems was Sheridan's political consultant and fundraiser, a service he also performed for Arpaio for many years. After helping Sheridan to an election win last fall, Willems now gets to call himself the chief of administration for the sheriff's office. According to Willems' LinkedIn page, he has zero experience in law enforcement, but he has loads of experience in raising money for politicians. Over the years, Willems raised millions for Arpaio and for himself in the process. Willems' clients of yore include notoriously racist State Senator Russell Pierce and the medical marijuana industry. During the 2024 election cycle, Willems consulted for Sheridan's campaign, earning $364,000. Now, Willems is being paid $185,000 for what a sheriff's office spokesperson described as a chief of staff position. As they say, to the victors go the spoils. All of it at taxpayer expense. Slendershot. Perhaps the biggest Arpaio retread is Sheridan himself. The newly minted sheriff's early track record in office is both self-serving and less than inspiring. During the 2024 campaign, Sheridan tried to downplay the actions that landed him in hot water with Snow, to the point of severely distorting the historical record. Then there was his failed attempt to cancel his first court-appointed monitor meeting as sheriff, and his announcement that the sheriff's office would no longer screen employees entering county jails for drugs and other contraband, despite a rash of drug overdoses in the facilities. And then, there are his repeated mischaracterizations of the state of the sheriff's office's compliance with Snow's orders. For instance, in a recent interview with Jim Sharp on KTAR's AZ Political Podcast, Sheridan asserted that his agency was down to a four-second discrepancy between stops for white versus Hispanic drivers, which Sheridan called pretty darn good. Not quite. The sheriff's office's own traffic stop annual report for 2024 showed a 14-second discrepancy, which differs from Sheridan's figure by a full New Year's Eve countdown. A sheriff's office flack admitted to New Times that Sheridan misspoke. In a 2014 training session with deputies, Sheridan notably scoffed at the idea that even a 14-second discrepancy is significant. In that same training session, Sheridan called Snow's order to cut out the racial profiling ludicrous and crap. As political politicians and commentators bitch about the more than $300 million price tag for Snow's mandated reforms, it's worth noting that Sheridan is a big reason the case has lasted so long and cost so much. Snow has reinforced and broadened oversight of the sheriff's office internal affairs investigations, finding that Sheridan and Arpaio willfully and systematically manipulated, misapplied, and subverted internal investigations to avoid imposing appropriate discipline. Sheridan also signed off on ridiculous investigations, like the Seattle operation, at a cost of $250,000. Described Arpaio in print as a successful and dedicated public servant, and fostered a laissez-faire office atmosphere that benefited a favorite detective who admitted to sleeping with the female victim of crimes that the agency was investigating. Phoenix civil rights attorney Joel Robbins, a well-known Arpaio foe who has sued the sheriff's office numerous times, says he's not impressed with Sheridan, whom he used to refer to as Slendershot, because Sheridan wasn't fat like Hendershot. When Penzone was elected over Sheridan in 2016, Robbins said, "Our business fell through the fucking floor." But he was okay with that. "It was the best day in my fucking life because I solved the problem, Robin said. I just didn't get money for a problem. But now, with Slendershot back in the saddle and a City Slicker-style cowboy hat on Slendershot's native Neoka noggin, Robin said that he's back to suing the sheriff's office again. It's business he doesn't want. I don't want people to get hurt, Robin said. I would rather have a good sheriff that actually gives a shit. But he's bringing back the bad guys, you know? This story is part of the Arizona Watchdog Project, a year-long reporting effort led by New Times and supported by the Trace Foundation in partnership with Deep South Today. Here's a story written by T.J. LeHoux and posted on the New Times website on August 14th. Phoenix introduces its new police chief. Five takeaways. On Monday, Matt Giordano officially started as chief of the Phoenix Police Department, one of the largest and most scrutinized forces in the nation. In a press conference held on his third day on the job, he struck a tone that was noticeably different from his predecessors. Giordano, a retired Phoenix Police commander who spent 20 years with Phoenix Police, was selected by City Manager Jeff Barton to lead the force that has been mired in controversy for years, culminating last year with a brutal 126-page report by the Department of Justice, documenting patterns of discrimination and excessive force by Phoenix cops. Giordano replaces former Chief Michael Sullivan, who was hired to lead the department on an interim basis in September 2022, as the DOJ began its probe into Phoenix Police. Before withdrawing from consideration for the permanent job in April, Sullivan passed some reforms but became deeply unpopular with rank-and-file officers, even as he and the city pushed back against independent oversight of the department. That oversight never came. Earlier this year, the Trump administration rescinded the entire DOJ report. But the conclusions of the report haven't been erased from the collective memory or from Giordano's. The information in that report didn't go away. What created that report didn't go away, Giordano said Wednesday. We should always be looking to evolve. That's a similar stance to the one Sullivan took, but with a greater acknowledgement of Phoenix Police's history of scandal and missteps. But Giordano himself was willing to strike a contrast between himself and the former chief. We just have different personalities, Giordano said. I enjoy getting out and talking. Sometimes it's detrimental to my schedule. Sullivan was a cautious, calculated tactician who rarely appeared before the media. One of the few times he made himself available to the press was for 5-minute interviews, given at an hour's notice by the department. Giordano is already breaking from his predecessor's colder modus operandi. 3 days into his tenure, he held a press conference and spoke relatively openly about his vision, hopes, and challenges leading the department. That's my difference, I think, in my leadership style versus Mike's, Giordano said. I'm not saying that Mike's leadership style was bad. We're just different people. If Wednesday's press conference was any indication, Giordano seems more open when speaking about police matters than Sullivan was. He also said, though without offering specifics, that the department should generally be transparent. It really does come down to open doors and being fully transparent as we're allowed to, he said. There's ongoing investigations, there's things we're not allowed to release, but for the most part, we should be almost an open book. Here are 5 other highlights from Giordano's introductory press conference. Giving hard news to cops. At the press conference, Giordano said it's his responsibility to be an open communicator with both concerned community members and officers. Even if I come out to deliver a message that the officers might not want to hear, Giordano explained, the fact that I'm willing to come out, explain what we're doing, why we're doing it, and listen to them, that's half the battle. Giordano is no stranger to issuing discipline for misbehaving officers. He ran the Arizona Police Officer Standards and Training Board for nearly 7 years, helming one of the only organizations with real power to hold law enforcement officers accountable. This year, the board has punished 21 current and former law enforcement officers from across Arizona. In 2024, ASPOST opened 48 investigations into officers and punished 43 cops, including for putting the muzzle of a gun to a woman's head, asking two high school girls when they lost their virginity, driving while under the influence, lying to superiors or investigators, and needlessly handcuffing an 82-year-old lady. How arrogant that was of me. Recalling his time as a younger man on the force, Giordano analyzed his own approach to community relations as less than great. He recounted being a sergeant years ago and going into a community meeting armed to the teeth with crime data that he hubristically used to tell residents what problems their neighborhood had. How arrogant that was of me to go into a community meeting and say that. But I thought I knew everything, Giordano said, noting that the 12 items he thought would be the community's top concerns were not at all. They had other concerns, so we need to listen to them. We need to engage them, he said, adding a self-effacing joke. We probably need to listen a lot more than we talk. I'm probably a really bad example of that. Not remembering old colleagues. Giordano began his presser with an analogy about how the department has changed since he left it in 2015 to work at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. I've been gone for 8.5 years. I feel like I went away to college. I just got back and my parents redecorated my room, Giordano said. It's still my house, it's still my room, but it looks completely different. He mentioned that moments before the press conference, he talked to someone in the hallway who asked if Giordano remembered him. He's got no hair anymore, and he's got a big bushy beard, Giordano said. Comments on AI. New Times asked Giordano about the department's new use of artificial intelligence to handle non-emergency dispatch calls, and what place he thought AI has in policing as the thorny technology expands into government. I'm over 50. I'm not even sure I understand what AI means, Giordano said, who didn't seem wary of potential abuses of using the technology in policing. If we can leverage technology using AI, I'm all for it. Let's give it a shot and try. Hurt people hurt people. One of Giordano's professional priorities is ensuring the well-being of his police officers. He recognizes the cycles of violence that come from over-policing certain communities and distrust of police that led to officers becoming emotionally unwell. Healthy employees are critical for the success of the Phoenix Police Department, Giordano said. You know, hurt people hurt people, and it's cumulative. So we need to make sure, even in the academy now, we're talking to young men and women about the stresses of this profession and saying, if you're having issues, talk to somebody. When I came on, that's not the direction we got. Remember that if you miss any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On-Demand Podcasts. Scroll down to the program you're interested in and click on Listen. Phoenix police use AI to answer non-emergency calls. Is that good? This next story was written by TJ LaHarue and was posted on the New Times website on August 13th. Starting today, the Phoenix Police Department will begin using artificial intelligence to answer non-emergency calls, joining departments in several other states across the country in adopting the technology for call centers. In a press release, Vice Mayor Anne O'Brien said that she led the effort to modernize the city's call centers. Phoenix also previously adopted a text system for people who call 911. When I learned that our 911 dispatchers were responsible for handling both emergency and non-emergency calls, and that many residents making non-emergency calls were giving up due to long wait times, I committed to finding a solution, O'Brien said in a written statement. After researching technology options, I requested city staff and the police department explore voice-activated AI-powered systems to handle non-emergency calls. Last year, Phoenix police handled more than 605,000 non-emergency calls, about 1,650 a day. While a Phoenix Police Department spokesperson has not yet provided Phoenix New Times with data on average non-emergency call wait times, any Phoenix resident who has called the line before knows the wait to speak with an operator is infamously long. The AI system called Call Triage was created by the Canadian firm Versaterm. The system will be used to identify the intent of non-emergency calls after asking callers a few questions before transferring the call to the appropriate city division. Whether someone's reporting a noise complaint, parking problem, or another issue that does not require an officer's immediate response, this new system ensures faster, more targeted help. And it helps our dispatchers stay focused where they're needed most, handling emergency calls, O'Brien said. The city's non-emergency number is 602-262-6151. O'Brien's office said the system speaks up to 36 languages. But with watchdogs flagging potential misuse of AI as it spreads into government, criminal justice, and policing, should Phoenix's program be a cause for concern? Christopher Moore, a professor of computer science and physics at the Santa Fe Institute, who also studies AI in the criminal justice system, told Phoenix New Times that he isn't worried about this particular use. More than anything, he's curious to see how effective it will be. As a switchboard, it sounds like an interesting experiment. It'll be just like when you call an airline or when you call a bank, Moore told New Times. And if it connects lots of people to the wrong person, they'll give the city valuable feedback about whether or not it's working. It'll either save people time or frustrate them and waste time. Moore noted that while this use of AI is likely benign, sometimes the technology can create problems. For instance, large language models like ChatGPT often make things up, which happened in New York City when chatbots gave citizens incorrect information about city code. In general, I think it's fine to use AI when you can check its work, Moore said. Where I get worried is when people become reliant on it as a replacement for humans, or when it's used to make consequential decisions. The vice mayor said that she got the idea to adopt AI for this purpose from Portland's use of AI for non-emergency calls. But what O'Brien didn't mention in the press release, and what KJZZ first reported, is that Portland discontinued using the service. KJZZ reported that Portland dropped the service due to hardware issues that conflicted with its outdated phone lines, an issue that Phoenix officials told the station they do not anticipate encountering. O'Brien's office mentioned that residents will always have the option of speaking to a live dispatcher if they prefer. Even though he sees the utility in the AI system, Moore might be the type to gravitate towards that option. Like a lot of people, the first thing I do when I hit an automated system is I press zero, I press pound, I press star. I say agent or representative, he said. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on the New Times website on August 15th. Friends of detained Peoria restaurateur plan last-ditch plea to Trump. Sitting around a back corner table at a Peoria sushi restaurant on Wednesday night, Aldo Requiza leaned in so that his wife could hear him better. "Hello, lady," Requiza said playfully. "How can I help you? Do you want to order a double cheeseburger and fries?" "Orange chicken, please," his wife, Kelly Yu, responded with a giggle. "It's a more apt order for the setting, as you would know. This restaurant, Kawaii Sushi and Asian Cuisine, is hers." She also knew that no one was going to spring from the kitchen with her meal. While Requiza sat in the busy restaurant, Yu was nearly 80 miles away in an immigration detention center in Eloy. This conversation, like so many between Yu and Requiza in the past several months, was conducted over video chat. Requiza's phone was propped up on a happy hour menu while supporters of Yu crowded around. Since May, Yu has been locked up in Eloy Detention Center, where she awaits deportation to her native China. She fled the Communist Party as a pregnant 18-year-old more than 2 decades ago, settling in Arizona and building a family and a thriving business. Kawaii Sushi is a popular neighborhood hotspot. Yu's daughter, Zita, is a U.S. citizen about to start her senior year at Arizona State University. Yu seemed to have it all, except legal status. She filed a claim for asylum when she arrived in the U.S., but it was denied in 2004. In 2005, Yu was issued a removal order, which she appealed. Her final appeal was dismissed in 2016. Last year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested her and began deportation proceedings. In January, Requiza, who is an American citizen, traveled to a Texas immigration center to marry her from behind the opposite side of a glass barrier. After being released with an ankle monitor, Yu was arrested again in May and sent to Eloy. In the months since, her plight has attracted considerable attention. Several members of Arizona's congressional delegation, notably all Democrats, have either met with Requiza or traveled to Eloy to meet with Yu. Senator Ruben Gallegos supports any efforts to stop the deportation of Kelly Yu. Gallegos spokesperson Taylor Tassler wrote to Phoenix New Times in an email. News organizations have covered her case as an example of President Donald Trump's overzealous immigration crackdown. Even political opponents, GOP Legislative District 29 Chair Lisa Everett and progressive organizer Brent Peake, have joined forces to support Yu. "This is not America," Everett said of Yu's detention. "I'm literally doing anything I can to help her. It's going to take overwhelming numbers." The outlook is bleak. Indeed, earlier this month, Requiza told New Times that he was all but resigned to the fact that Yu will be sent back to China. Before that happens, though, Yu's supporters are planning one last Hail Mary. With Everett's help, they are planning to lobby Donald Trump directly. "I wish I could speak my feelings to the president," Yu told New Times over a video call from the detention center on Wednesday evening. "We may have come here illegally, but we are trying to ask for help. We deserve a second chance so we can keep our family together." appealing to Trump. Months earlier, Everett and Peek led opposing protests outside the offices of GOP Representative Abe Hamada in Surprise. After hashing out ways to keep the peace over a meal at Whataburger, the two struck up a cordial relationship. Last Sunday, Peek asked Everett if she might be on the same page about Yu's detention. Everett was. Since that day, they've embarked on a full-court press to advocate for Yu's release. Everett supports ICE arresting and deporting the worst of the worst, she said. But Yu, who has no criminal record outside of remaining in the country illegally, does not fit that bill. Anyone who doesn't feel like Kelly's case deserves a second look and we need to bring her home, I think that they have not listened with an open heart and an open mind to the story, Everett said. Life is not black and white, and that's what they want to make it. Everett and all of Yu's supporters hope Trump feels the same way. Urquiza, who voted for Trump, thinks the president is the only person who can do anything to stop his wife's deportation. He's a human being as well, Urquiza said. That's all I need from him. Just listen to what I have to say. Getting the president's attention isn't easy, but Everett hopes she can help. She's begun reaching out to contacts in 17 states to call the White House communication line, which she has also called herself. Everett has not yet attempted to enlist Hamada, whose district includes Peoria, in the effort. A spokesperson for Hamada, whose parents overstayed their visa when he was a child before an immigration judge granted them reprieve from deportation, does not return a request for comment on Yu's case. Whether Trump would take action on Yu's case remains unknown. Given Trump's anti-immigration zeal, despite having married an immigrant himself, it might be a long shot. We're putting up a fight, Urquiza said, and we're not going to give up until it's over. If Trump were to intervene, he could do so in one of two ways, says Salvador Macias, a Phoenix-based immigration lawyer who is not involved in the case. First, Trump could recommend that Kelly receive a bond hearing, which would allow Yu to be released back to her family, but wouldn't necessarily save her from deportation. However, Trump's Department of Homeland Security has cracked down on bond hearings and argued that immigration judges, who technically serve under the executive branch of government, don't have jurisdiction to grant a bond hearing. The second option is trying to get her paroled, Macias said, which wouldn't necessarily give her status, but just try to get her out. Like with bond hearings, Trump's administration has been uninterested in providing that option. However, Macias said, if Trump told ICE, hey, for this person, give them approval, you could be released that way. Either avenue would simply be a play for time, allowing time for the processing of Urquiza's I-130 petition, which is a step toward allowing foreign family members to immigrate to the U.S. Because immigration offenses are generally civil infractions and not criminal, Trump's broad pardon power does not come into play. Trump could waive Yu's two-decade-old entrance into the community without inspection misdemeanor, but she'd still lack residency. Trump cannot unilaterally grant legal status, which is a legislative power. For that same reason, President Barack Obama wasn't able to give green cards to the undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. Instead, he had to use an executive order to create the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program in order to prevent them from being deported to countries they barely knew. Is Trump inclined to intervene? When asked about Yu's case, White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson told New Times to reach out to ICE and did not respond to follow-up questions. ICE has not provided a statement on Yu's case, though DHS spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin previously told the Arizona Republic that Yu has no legal pathways to remain in the U.S. Neighborhood legacy. Legal status or not, Yu has become a fixture of her community. Yu employs 30 people at her two sushi restaurants and is also the co-owner of a counter-service poke restaurant in Glendale. A third Kauai sushi location is in the process of opening in Peoria's Trilogy neighborhood. Her restaurants employ many students from nearby Liberty High School. She and Kauai Sushi have been strong supporters of local baseball teams and the Peoria Police and Fire Departments. Each holiday season, Kauai provides platters of lo mein and fried rice to the first responders, although Urquiza admitted the fire department does seem to like the pizza place next door better. The restaurant is Kelly's dream, Urquiza said. I'm not going to let it die. One longtime loyal customer is Jeremy Helfgott, a political strategist who lives near Yu's first Kauai location. Helfgott met Yu when he first visited the restaurant in 2014 and has been to Kauai more times than I can count. His favorite dishes are Yu's Japanese pan-seared flounder and the tsukiji sushi roll. I've asked her for the recipe. She's not going to give it to me, Helfgott said. But as long as I keep enjoying it, I'll keep asking for it. Yu, with her bubbly personality, was almost always there. She'd be out at the front greeting guests or walking around to tables to chat with regulars and newcomers alike. Another fixture of the restaurant is Zita, Yu's daughter, and Minimi, who splits her time between the restaurants and studying in Tempe. Speaking via video chat from Eloy, Yu remains in high spirits, but she gets choked up talking about her daughter. It's difficult not being there, Yu said as a tear rolled down her cheek. She's going to graduate next year. I'm going to be missing her graduation. She just started dating, and I'm missing the chance to meet her boyfriend. Through it all, Yu continues to advocate for others, even in Eloy. She's connected other detainees' husbands with Urquiza. At least three have come to Kauai Sushi, so Urquiza can help them navigate the process of seeing their wives, downloading the correct apps to connect with them, and paying for commissary. By the end of Wednesday evening, Urquiza's phone had been passed around the restaurant so customers could offer Yu their best wishes. Wearing a large gray sweatshirt, Yu gave a double thumbs up to the camera before Urquiza signed off. On the other side of the screen, she could see her American dream, her thriving restaurant, loving husband, successful daughter, and supportive friends. But she has no idea when she'll be surrounded by them again. Hang tight, Helfgott told her. We're on it. Thank you. I will keep my head up, Yu responded. Love you all. New light rail line could raise historic Phoenix homes residents fear. This next story was written by Emily Holshauser and was posted on the New Times website on August 11th. Valley Metro is planning to add light rail from downtown Phoenix to the Arizona Capitol, but a group of residents worry that one proposed route may require bulldozing local businesses and several historic homes. On July 30th, a collective of Central Phoenix residents gathered in the disco ball-adorned space at Club Contact to air their concerns about the light rail expansion. The meeting was held by the Woodland Neighborhood Association, whose neighborhood is a historic district recognized by the City of Phoenix and the National Register of Historic Places. Woodland Neighborhood is bounded by 7th and 16th Avenues to the east and west, and by Van Buren Street and an alley north of Adams Street to the north and south. The proposed route, part of Valley Metro's long-awaited light rail expansion known as the Capitol Extension, would require demolishing multiple homes and businesses in the area. We are here today to protect Phoenix's history and protect our neighbors' homes, said Tommy McCone, a four-year Woodland resident at the event. We're very devastated to hear that this was even a possibility. The Capitol Extension has been in the works for a decade, first conceived in 2015 when Phoenix voters approved the city's Transportation 2050 plan. The project aims to connect existing light rail infrastructure in downtown to the area around the Capitol building and then beyond to the Desert Sky Transit Center in West Phoenix. But the Woodland neighborhood was not initially in the project's crosshairs. Valley Metro originally proposed a single-track one-way loop along Washington Street, Adams Street, 19th Avenue, and Jefferson Street. That changed last year when Maricopa County voters renewed the Proposition 400 transportation tax. A year earlier, in a compromise with Republicans to place the measure on the 2024 ballot, Governor Katie Hobbs agreed to include restrictions on the light rail construction near Capitol buildings. That forced Valley Metro to rethink its plans. The light rail operator first publicized three new proposals in late April, inviting area residents to provide feedback online and in two meetings that were held in May. Maps of the proposed routes included several buildings shaded in red with a star in the center, indicating a potential building impact. For many in the neighborhood, it was the first time they heard about the proposals. I felt like the city officials didn't want to do this, resident and neighborhood association member Hannah Langmaid told Phoenix New Times. I think the city legislators scared them with their last-minute change to the law of not building 150 feet from the Capitol when they had this plan for years. Capitol Extension Options. The Capitol Extension will be a 1.6-mile loop with split stations and trains running in opposite directions. At issue is by what route that extension will connect to the 10-mile I-10 West extension, which will be constructed afterward. Two proposed routes dip south around the Capitol, either at 15th or 16th Avenue, before running along Madison Street and eventually turning up 19th Avenue. The third, which would affect Woodland, cuts up north at 16th Avenue before running east along Van Buren Street. All three proposed routes are being considered for both mostly ground level or mostly elevated configurations. All of the pathways would potentially impact at least one building, though some routes endanger more structures than others. The mostly elevated version of the 15th Avenue South pathway affects only one building, with additional potential impacts to a historic cemetery and parking garage. The 16th Avenue South elevated pathway would implicate one building, but nothing else. However, both of the 15th Avenue pathways would cut through the Woodland Historic District, which is dotted with turn-of-the-century bungalows, some dating back to the 1880s. Should Valley Metro choose to build the light rail at ground level west on 15th Avenue, a cluster of homes and businesses near 15th Avenue and several businesses along Van Buren Street would have to go. Valley Metro would not specify to New Times an exact number of structures that would be affected. But during the meetings in May, officials told residents that the plan would affect five homes. The Neighborhood Association says three businesses would also be demolished under this plan. They would destroy the neighborhood to the point where nobody would want to live here, Langmaid said. I don't want the neighborhood to go down. The Neighborhood Association's official preference for the light rail pathway is the 16th Avenue South mostly elevated option. It destroys the least amount of buildings, does the least amount of damage to utility lines. They don't need to add a whole lot of extra lights or crosswalks, and it's mostly elevated, Langmaid said. In a statement written to New Times, Valley Metro said, that residents will continue to have opportunities to voice their opinions about the project. Input from residents, including the Woodland neighborhood, property and business owners, and stakeholders in and around the state capital area, continues to play a critical role in project development and identifying our path forward, said Juliana Vasquez Keating, a public information officer for Valley Metro. Valley Metro and City of Phoenix staff continue to evaluate all design possibilities for both the Capitol extension and the connection with the I-10 West extension. Additional outreach on design and public art elements is planned for later this year, with construction anticipated to begin in 2026. More information about the project is available on Valley Metro's website, including materials from the community meetings. However, it is not clear when residents will have another opportunity to provide feedback on the proposals or exactly when Valley Metro will make a decision. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.